My name is Dave Van Meter, and I'm an associate professor here at the College of Veterinary Medicine and Biomedical Sciences in Colorado State University. I teach the introductory nutrition and metabolism course here in the veterinary curriculum.
What's the most unusual diet of any animal that you know?
I particularly enjoy ruminant nutrition. And ruminants would be the sheep, cattle, goats. And sort of related animals would be the camels, the camelids, we call them, the old world camels, and then the new world camels, which are the alpacas and the llamas and the vicuñas. And llamas and alpacas up in the Andes, where the snow covers a lot of the tundra for most of the year, they can get by on lichen and a few strands of dormant grass and not much else. And it has to do with their capacity to retain nitrogen to be reused as protein in their bodies. They also retain other essential elements that are often deprived during certain growth states of the surrounding forage. For example, they can retain sodium and phosphorus. I've always kind of found that fascinating with them.
Those big animals, they eat lichens, they eat moss, and they survive.
That's right. They have a remarkable capacity with the help with some bacteria in their stomachs, remarkable capacity to turn compounds in nature that mammals can't digest on their own. With the help of these stomach bacteria, they can convert cellulose into usable energy, and that's something that you and I can't do.
We don't do it very much at all. We have some gut microbes, but not enough for being that total vegetarian on lichens and leaves.
Right. We have a relatively limited gut flora, not to say they're not important. They play a tremendous role in protecting our health and maintaining our immunity, but these animals, the animals with a huge fermentation vat in their stomach, as well as the horses whose fermentation vat lies at the back end of the gastrointestinal tract in the colon, they have a remarkable ability to utilize bacteria, give the bacteria a safe home, a good haven, and in return the bacteria do some remarkable things for them. For example, bacteria can simply take nitrogen in feed and turn it into all the essential amino acids that the animal needs for its daily protein needs. They can take very unrelated carbon sources and turn them into the essential fatty acids that camels and llamas and alpacas and horses and cattle and sheep and goats need to maintain normal health of their cell membranes and other things. And so it's a pretty good setup. It's a sort of microcosm of symbiosis in nature. One species of animal helping another species. In this case, it's the multitude of different microbes that reside in their gut.
Well, we always think of these as herding animals that are our livestock when we raise them for food. But they have their own livestock inside of them.
Exactly. They've got to tend to the needs of their microorganisms if they're going to stay healthy.
In fact, I've heard that if an animal that's ruminant, like a deer, is in cold weather and it can't feed its microorganisms, it can freeze to death.
That's partially true. Typically, when those animals freeze, it's because they've been chronically without nutrition and they've lost enough subcutaneous fat and other forms of insulation that they don't make it through the winter. But you're right, the heat generated by fermentation in the stomach is part of the reason that elk and caribou can survive where they can, that plus their fur coats. But yeah, the heat of fermentation offers a lot of cold protection.
And we think of these animals as vegetarians because we think that the main thing they do is eat leaves, stalks, flowers, grain. But really what they're eating is the microbes. They're eating other animals.
Right. What happens is that these grazing livestock will ingest the stemmy parts of plants as well as some of the seeds and grains and things that we can digest. But a good portion of their diet is composed of cellulose and related compounds that mammalian enzymes can't digest. And so these bacteria do it for them. And the bacteria can take some very simple carbon and nitrogen compounds out of this feed and turn it into remarkably high quality protein by assimilating these compounds into their own microbial bodies. Then when those microbes die and pass through the gastrointestinal tract, they themselves are digested, and that protein and the essential fatty acids that they create for their own cellular use, the microbes, then are digested and made available for the host.
Are you saying that these carb-eating animals, when it gets into their bloodstream, they're eating a high-fat diet?
No, not at all. The amount of fat actually in these diets is very, very small, much less than what an omnivore or a carnivore would eat. But what the rumen microbes, again, the rumen infers that we've got a fermentation vat that lies ahead of the stomach in which billions of bacteria and protozoa and fungi live. What these rumen bacteria can do is take very simple sources of carbon, such as cellulose, and can convert it into fat.
Let me get my head around this. What the animals chew on and get in their stomachs starts out as carbohydrates, cellulose, and other carbs. After the microbes digest out the carbs for their own benefit, they die and they're basically digested by the animal, the ruminant, mm-hmm. the deer, or the mm-hmm. camel. The majority of calories that are actually entering the bloodstream for that ruminant, are they sugars or are they fatty acids?
Well, the majority of nutrients that come out of the fermentation vat, be it the stomach of a cow or the colon of a horse, are what we call volatile fatty acids. These are very short-chain fatty acids. A normal fat in a human cell would have a carbon length of 18 to 20 carbons. These are 2, 3, and 4 carbon precursor molecules that are released from the stomach, taken up by the bloodstream, and then processed for use by the animal. Some of the carbon that these microbes ingest, they convert to what are called the essential fatty acids, which are much more longer chain and complex. And then when those microbes are digested, those minute amounts of essential fatty acids, which are much longer, come out of the microbes' bodies and are digested.
Is butter those short chain fatty acids primarily?
Well, butter is composed of longer chain fats. Typically those come from milk fat, and that's, again, the cow has in her mammary gland taken these short volatile fatty acid precursors and linked them together to form a much longer carbon molecule that we identify as milk fat. If we wanted to get a good slug of what would be a volatile fatty acid, probably the easiest way to do it would be to put a teaspoon of balsamic vinegar on something and eat it, because that's a relatively small organic acid and relatively close to what is coming out of the rumen.
So what you just described was not an oil. You described a vinegar.
Right.
And a vinegar is more like what's coming out of these animals. That's a fatty acid still?
Yeah, it's a small chain. It's a small carbon chain acid, but that's what's coming out of these animals' stomach after fermentation destroys the cellulose and a lot of the sugar that might be present in the forages as well, in the leaves and in certain parts of the seeds. There's quite a bit of starch and even some sugar, but the microbes destroy that, convert it to these short-chain volatile fatty acids, the closest analog of which that I can come up with is vinegar. These enter the animal's bloodstream, and now it's up to the animal to convert these into different structures for its own tissue needs. Like you just mentioned, a lactating mom would turn those short-chain volatile fatty acids into 18 carbon-long milk fats and give it to her young that way.
Could we humans take vinegar and turn it into fat in our bodies?
Through a limited capacity, yeah. It represents a hydrocarbon source that we can convert in our livers into whatever we might need. Depending on the chemical structure of these acids that we might take in through our diet, they may or may not be able to be turned into blood sugar, but they certainly may be able to be turned into fat or converted for use in amino acids.
I've never had anyone tell me that free fatty acids taste like vinegar. And now I'm wondering, triglycerides, free fatty acids in our body, if we could distill them out, would they taste like vinegar?
It depends a bit on the carbon link. Triglycerides are free fatty acids that are linked to a molecule called glycerol. So it's a triglyceride. When you mobilize fat out of your body to, say, you go for a run and you're going to use some fat up and burn some fat, you don't essentially metabolize fat per se. What happens is your fat cells release these free fatty acids into the bloodstream. I can't think of a food that would have large amounts of free fatty acids present in them, because typically they're packaged as triglycerides in most of the foods that we're familiar with, so they're not in free form.
Yes, so the triglyceride is like having a little branch with three cherries on it.
Exactly.
And plucks off of fatty acids. So that happens inside the cells. So the cells get to eat some vinegar.
The cells, the liver cells in particular, are very, very creative with what they can do with a fairly simple carbon source. The liver of the ruminant species, and to a lesser but significant degree the horse, very creative at taking unusual carbon sources that these microbes have created, vinegar-like short-chain fatty acids, and turning them into a variety of different things in the liver, including blood sugar. Ruminants and horses need glucose for their tissues, but the paradox is that the microbes take most of the glucose in the feed and ferment it, particularly in cattle. So what the ruminant has to do, and again to a lesser degree the horse, what they have to do is they have to say, okay, my brain needs glucose, my mammary gland needs glucose if I'm lactating, if I'm pregnant, my fetus needs a tremendous amount of glucose. What these animals have to do is perform what's called gluconeogenesis, generation of new glucose from non-glucose sources in the body.
And glucose is a word for sugar, so they make their own sugar.
They make their own blood sugar, exactly.
What is the normal blood sugar for all of these ruminants?
Oh, it's a bit lower than what you see for people and for common house pets. It's typically runs 50 to 90 milligrams per deciliter, which is a titch lower than what you would expect in a dog or a cat or a human that's up closer, 100, 120, maybe as low as 80 or 90, depending on the species. So they're a notch lower.
Do they ever get diabetes?
It is extraordinarily rare in grazing livestock to have diabetes, either type 1, where there's not enough insulin being made, or type 2, where the animal typically is adult, maybe heavier than it should be, and the tissues become resistant to the effects of insulin.
What animals do get diabetes?
Dogs, fairly common. Cats get the adult onset type 2, which is associated with obesity in humans. Hamsters and gerbils can become diabetic, and some of the primates can become diabetic, in particular the prosimians, the tamarins and marmosets, have a tendency to develop adult onset diabetes in certain situations.
But not the ruminants, who make their own sugar.
Right. What happens is, even if a ruminant eats a high sugar diet, let's say you find some sugar cane in the tropics and you find a water buffalo ruminant and you feed it to them, those ruminant microbes are going to take that sugar in that diet and break it apart into these small chain acids. Then what happens is those small chain acids go to the ruminant's liver, the water buffalo's liver, where they have to repackage it to fit their needs. And so part of the reason why diabetes is so rare in ruminants is there's this precursor step where dietary glucose is broken down. Then they have to repackage their own glucose to meet their needs. And so you don't get the so-called sugar high, the rapid rise in blood sugar that occurs when you or I eat a candy bar, because we don't have rumen microbes ahead of our bloodstream to break them apart. And so in our digestive tract, it goes boom, right into our blood. Our blood sugar shoots up and we demand a lot of insulin and can become obese, obviously, if that continues.
How about ruminant insulin levels? What are they? Are they high or low?
They are very, very modest and low compared to, say, humans. And obviously the reason for that is when they eat a normal diet, the amount of glucose, the amount of sugar that comes out of their gastrointestinal tracts is tiny, because, again, the microbes have digested a lot of it into these volatile fatty acids. And so ruminants don't need as much insulin to handle even a sugary meal, because the microbes in their stomach are going to take it apart for them in advance.
It sounds like they don't have a lot of strain on their pancreas that produces the insulin.
They don't. The the fact that the dietary sugar is destroyed for them by these rumen microbes makes the amount of insulin that they need at any given time pretty low and pretty modest.
They are getting enough sugar to get by, but their bodies prefer not to have a lot of sugar in it. Why is that, do you suppose?
In the resting state, their tissues have a fairly low and basal demand for glucose, for sugar, that is met by their liver converting these other compounds. But their resting blood sugar is lower. Their bodies are not accommodated to handling the swings in blood sugar that occur with the meal-eating animals. Ruminants graze. They eat a long time during the day and rest periodically. But if you think about it, they're sort of doing a pattern of food ingestion that is low level and constant, and that keeps those microbes in their stomachs happy.
They also get energy from fats. We've been talking about the vinegary kind of fats, but do they do what other animals like humans do, where any free fatty acids that are floating around in our bloodstream get changed into more complex storage forms or other kinds of forms?
Again, because their plant diets typically don't have a lot of fat in them, we don't see a lot of dietary origin fat going into their bloodstream. We can, however, add vegetable oil or even other forms of triglycerides into animal diets if those animals have a heavy energy requirement. What the microbes in the stomach will do is break those down, convert them into their own version of what they think fat should be, and provide that in a trickle into the ruminant's bloodstream. So let's say you're talking about a fat cell on the rear end of a cow, and that cow is undergoing a heavy energy demand. She will mobilize that fat from her fat cells and break it down for energy for use in her liver, her muscle, her brain, just like humans do.
Cows basically make their own sugars and fats from this vinegary stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they don't bring glucose into their bloodstreams. They bring these fatty acids that they can turn into sugars or fats.
That's correct. And it's very important to make a distinction here. The fats that people typically eat cannot be used in hardly any degree at all to make blood sugar. Okay? What the fermentation in the stomach allows is these three and similar length carbon chain fats to be converted into glucose. What we eat in terms of fat in our diet is typically longer chain fatty acids linked to one glycerol molecule to form a triglyceride, and those molecules have a very limited capacity to generate to be turned into glucose in our bodies.
Now, that's also true for dogs, it's true for cats, it's true for polar bears, it's true for all of the non-ruminants, is that right?
That's correct. Dietary fat, if you think of the molecular structure of dietary fat that those species typically eat, again, it's a 3-carbon glycerol backbone, and these three long chain carbons, you call them the cherries on the tree. The glycerol backbone would be the tree, and these long carbon chains would be the cherries on that tree, and there's 3 cherries per tree in a triglyceride. Those fats can be used for energy, but that glycerol molecule is worth only 1/2 of a glucose molecule, and so by nature, fats that these species ingest do not typically bring about a significant rise in blood sugar.
If a person or a polar bear or a dog doesn't eat sugar in its diet or doesn't eat enough to make that be the way that blood sugars rise, can they make sugars for themselves?
Yeah, all species are capable of the process of making their own blood sugar, and that's called, blood sugar is glucose, so again, that's called gluconeogenesis. What a polar bear will do, if let's say it eats a fish, okay? High protein, high fat, not a lot of carbohydrate in fish. What that polar bear will do would be the same thing that you or I would do if we ate fish all day, and that is that our livers would say, we need to keep our blood sugar up. That's what keeps you alert. That's what keeps your muscles going. It keeps your red cells happy.
Can we use fats in our bodies to keep our muscles going, to keep our heart going? Are those good sources of fuel for humans?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if fats, the right kinds in moderation, provide people and animals with a tremendously abundant source of energy. It's up to us to make sure that we burn it, or else we're going to become heavy. We'll probably put on weight if we eat a high-fat diet and we don't work it off. But yes, fats can be utilized by a variety of tissues for energy. Muscle is tremendous at burning fat.
I've heard that polar bears in the wild will kill like a seal, mm-hmm. and they will peel off the fat layer and some of the meat. And after a while, they go, yeah, I've had enough of that meat now. And they leave the rest for the Arctic foxes and the seagulls. Is that true or not?
I'm not a good polar bear dietitian. I can't honestly say. What the polar bear will do to maintain its blood sugar, however, is it will take proteins from that meat, and its liver can convert certain amino acids, most of them, fairly readily, into...
All right, so whenever somebody eats more protein than the body needs, it's got to do something with that extra protein. And so to even process it, it has to turn it into sugar so that it can excrete the nitrogen and do something with the extra stuff that's come in?
That's correct. The protein that is ingested in a diet has multiple potential metabolic fates, okay? The simplest is to provide the protein needs for that person to just, you know, to make new muscle and turn over proteins and enzymes and things that break down just through chemical wear and tear. That's priority one. Any extra protein that's left can be converted into blood sugar through the process we just described. If we eat a lot of protein and we don't exercise, that protein can be broken down and repackaged as fat.
So it turns into sugar first, mm-hmm. and then the body goes, where am I going to put this sugar? And it turns it into fat.
One of the most potent signals for any animal to start turning something into fat is when the cells are chocked full of a compound called glycogen, which is a storage form of sugar. So if we go back to our high protein example, person eats a high protein diet, will meet their protein needs, will have excess protein present. The protein can be broken down and repackaged into sugar to maintain blood sugar. And it will also go to cells, some of that sugar will go to cells and start being stored as this form of glycogen. When that reaches capacity, if that person continues to eat protein and not exercise, that protein will be broken down, the tissues have enough glycogen, the blood sugar is fine, and it'll start being packaged as fat. So there's a clause to the high protein diet in terms of provoking weight loss. If you don't exercise and ingest higher than normal amounts of protein, you're probably going to put on weight.
Whether it's a cow or a horse or a rabbit or a person or a dog, and suddenly there's some terrifying or enraging situation. The dog has to fight. The rabbit has to run away from the hawk. What kind of energy do they use to do that?
In veterinary medicine, we call it the fight or flight response. And that's typically the animal recognizes that there's a life threat and certain nervous and hormonal mechanisms are kicked in to mobilize sugar for use in the body, and the blood sugar typically rises very rapidly. We call that a physiologic, meaning there's a physiologic explanation for it, hyper, meaning high glycemia, meaning high blood sugar as a result of a physiologic event, that being terror or provocation or some sort of emotional stress, defending the nest, defending the brood. In those instances, the animal will mobilize storage forms of sugar like glycogen to provide a spike in blood sugar so that it's readily available to enter muscle cells when the fight or the running away begins.
How high do those blood sugars go in those fight or flight situations?
Oh, it can go several hundred milligrams per deciliter over the normal resting state of 70 to 80 milligrams per deciliter. We can see blood sugars in 200 to 300 milligram per deciliter range in some species following a stressful event. Sometimes it's just going to the veterinary office. When we interpret blood sugars, we have to take into account the animal's physiologic state at the time that the blood was drawn. And so we try to be gentle and soothing so that that spike is minimized.
If you have a dog that's panicked about how you're taking its blood, its blood sugar will be, you said a normal one is maybe 80 for a dog. It may be 300.
That's correct. And again, just as MDs rely on skilled nurses to obtain a smooth blood draw with minimal concern to the patient, be it a baby or an adult, we too rely on skilled technicians who can calm and soothe the animal, get that needle in really quick, and mitigate that fear response such that there went one right now. Another across the hall in the exam room across the hall, such that that effect on, say, the blood sugar of a patient that we're monitoring can be minimized.
But this is a normal response for animals. They need to be able to run from the tiger or be the tiger.
Exactly. So it's both prey and predator animals can experience this. Predators have a tendency to do it to a greater degree because if they don't catch something, they're not going to be around longer. So if you look at the physiologic hyperglycemia response in, say, a feline, lion to domestic cat, or carnivore like a dog, it's much higher than the bounce in blood sugar that we see in the concerned cow.
And yet even that placid cow can have a sharp rise in blood sugar if it's time to fight or flee.
Yeah, it typically is a very upset cow. But yeah, absolutely, we can see blood sugars go. They won't go as high as a carnivore. They won't get up to 200 or 300 typically, but they'll go up above their modest normal physiologic range. And we theorize that that is their mechanism of mobilizing stored sugar in their cells to be able to be used to get the heck away from the animal that's chasing.
For a cow, then, maybe a blood sugar of 150 would be real high.
Yeah, that'd be something that would raise an eyebrow. Yeah, we'd have to make sure that we knew what that cow's physiologic status was when the blood sample was taken. That said, if the cow has a fracture, something that causes a lot of acute pain, then, yep, we can see that blood sugar get where you said it would be, yeah, 150, 170.
Surgery can do this.
Absolutely. The hormone cortisol and the hormone epinephrine both tell the animal something's wrong and it's time to call on our reserves. So we mobilize stored sugar and we even mobilize some stored fat when those hormones are released, and they help us get through whatever stressful event we're getting through. And animals are the same way.
We've talked about the ruminants and how you said that their blood sugars generally range from 50 to 90.
Mm-hmm.
Nice and steady. How about dogs and cats? What are their normal blood sugars when they're not afraid?
Yeah, when they're not afraid, they're up where people typically are. You're 75 up to 120, 130 in that range. Birds, for reasons we don't entirely understand, typically run blood sugars, resting blood sugars, happy bird, resting blood sugar up around 300. So much higher basal level. Now, why that is and why birds have been adapted to run at that level, it's hard to say. You mentioned hummingbirds earlier. Being birds, their blood sugars can be up. And if you watch a hummingbird, you might sort of surmise that somebody with that level of activity might constantly need some readily available fuel in its bloodstream at all times to buzz around.
Interestingly enough, their average blood sugar that's gotten sticky,
mm-hmm,
with sugars, the blood cells, is lower than a human's.
Yeah, A1C, of course, is an index of how long a blood sugar has been high in an animal's body. And so for those hummingbirds, yeah, it's high, but it's being used and turned over very, very quickly. For a diabetic, that can be an indicator of a problem. A high A1C index would indicate that the blood sugar is sticking around in the blood too long and not necessarily being used. Does that make sense?
It does, because that means it's sticking around and sticking literally.
Well, A1C indicates that the glucose has had a chance, the blood sugar, I'm sorry, has had a chance to become integrated into some of the proteins that are in our red cells, okay? And that's what the test picks up. But what a high A1C would indicate is that The sugar goes up into the bloodstream, stays elevated, and doesn't get used. So one of the wonderful ways to bring a high blood sugar down and a high blood sugar over a long period of time down is to exercise regularly, to use it, to turn it over.
I gather that the other thing that can keep blood sugars from being used is if insulin levels get too high for too long and the cells become resistant to the signal of insulin, which means they can't burn fat because the insulin levels are high, and they also can't burn sugar because when the cells are resistant, it locks out sugar.
Correct. And you've described adult onset type 2 diabetes, which is becoming extremely prevalent in the adult population of the United States. And it also occurs in dogs and in cats that are adult, overweight, and inactive. I always tell the students that insulin is the hormone that puts the groceries away. It moves the nutrients into cells. Now, if we eat a high energy, high carbohydrate, high calorie diet, and we don't exercise, pretty soon those cells, the cupboards in our body, are going to be full of groceries, right? The cells have a mechanism of saying, hey, we're full. We've had all of these groceries crammed into us already, and they lose their sensitivity to insulin. As the person continues to eat a high carbohydrate diet, the blood sugar goes up from the diet, but the sugar can't enter the cells because the cells are saying, we don't want any more, okay? We got all the groceries we need. The person's blood sugar becomes chronically elevated and the person becomes a type 2 diabetic. The high blood sugar can induce changes in peripheral nerves. It changes the lining of the blood vessels in our extremities. It increases our risk of atherosclerotic disease, and it's becoming a major health concern.
This is true for adult dogs and cats too. This can happen to them.
Absolutely. Yes, it can. And it is phenomenal how modest the exercise can be to bring this under control. In humans, 20 minutes of moderate activity per day can help bring this under control. The same holds true for pets. And I know in some small houses and apartments, they say getting a cat adequate exercise may be difficult. If left to go outdoors, there are certain dangers out there, cars and foxes and so forth. But even indoors, just healthy play with a cat, a string on the end of a pole, a laser pointer, a flashlight on the wall that drives them crazy, they'll chase that around for a while. So a modest level of exercise for a pet can help the tissues to say, let's burn some of this stored calories, let's burn some of this stored groceries. And once they do that, they're willing to let some of this insulin start to affect and bring some more of this sugar in and therefore drop that blood sugar down.
How about the kind of food that dogs and cats eat? Can that make a difference too?
Yeah, unfortunately, some of the things that humans like to eat as treats, the sugary snack food and the high carbohydrate snack food, will do the exact same thing to our pet's blood sugar and pack a lot of groceries into their cells as what happens to us. There is some data out there to suggest that providing pets with carbohydrate sources with a low glycemic index, and there are a variety of pet foods out there with weight management on their label that use a combination of high dietary fiber and carbohydrate sources that have a lower glycemic index. And let me explain that. A glycemic index is essentially a measurement with how readily those carbohydrates spike our blood sugar and for how long. Okay? So when we feed our pets, especially our adult pets and those with limited exercise because of old animals get sore joints and those sorts of things, if we feed our pets diets high in fiber with carbohydrate sources of a low glycemic index and good balance of protein and fat, we can help to head off those problems with type 2 diabetes.
A dog store owner told me that a lot of foods for dogs and cats were made with very high carbohydrate contents because they last longer on the shelf that way.
Yeah, corn-based, for example, a lot of corn in diets, it's abundant. It's easy to find in America. There's an excess of it, at least as long as, you know, ethanol, biofuels go a different direction. Those common grain sources, if fed to abundance in an animal that's maybe not exercising like it should, can cause weight gain and trigger those secondary changes in type 2 diabetes. Now, if we're talking about a dog that's out active running 2, 3, 4 years old, just like active 20-year-old people, athletes, well, they can handle a higher carbohydrate diet and not get these changes because they're burning them. They're expending them for energy.
Did cats and dogs evolve to eat high carbohydrate diets?
Not necessarily. They're predator animals. Their metabolism seems to modulate a bit more on a protein and fat diet. Fat and protein does have a limited shelf life, so your dog food or your pet store owner was correct in that sense. Fats in foods become rancid over time and oxidize and change their taste. So some moderation, not that I'm advocating that, you know, every pet go out there and eat all protein diet. That would probably be too expensive for many folks who own pets. But again, veterinarians, as your pet goes through life and becomes less active with time, as we all do when we age, your veterinarian can help you pick out certain types of dog foods that might be higher in protein, higher in fiber, lower in these blood sugar spiking carbohydrates, I'll call them, grain sources and so forth, to help alleviate these changes that we see in type 2 diabetes.
One thing that got me interested in doing this is our 13-year-old cat named Andy. I would have brought him along, but cats like to stay home.
Sure.
You would have liked to meet him. About 3 years ago, he was sleeping all the time. He was drinking water all the time. In the winter, he was getting very heavy, and he was sleeping all the time, and he couldn't jump up on the table anymore. Well, signs of some problems.
Cats, as they age, are particularly prone to putting on body fat. They do it very well. About as well as we do as humans. They are very wonderful little models of type 2 diabetes in people. And when the blood sugar starts to stay chronically increased, what happens is the blood sugar spills into the kidney, and the cells that form urine see that sugar, and water moves from the body into the urine to balance out the water balance. And so an animal that is developing any form of diabetes, one of the most common things people see is they're urinating more and they're drinking more.
And that's what Andy, our 10-year-old cat at that time, was doing. He had been raised as a kitten on dry cat food, and we tried to feed him other kinds of food, but he would only nibble at it. He believes in dry cat food. Finally, we have a vet where we live who said there's a new kind of cat food out by a company called Evo, which has a long enough shelf life, but it's mainly fat and then protein and a little bit of carbohydrate.
That, it sounds to me like that's the South Beach diet for cats, is what it was, what that boiled down to being, or the Atkins diet for cats, you know, modulating blood sugar, but providing enough protein and fats to meet the animal's daily energy needs.
And so this is 3 years later. He doesn't get fat in the winter the way that he did last summer. He was out in our woodpile and strutting through the yard with the voles that he was catching, you know, the little mouse-like creatures, and then he ate them on our favorite rug and saved us the gallbladder. He jumps up on the table with great pride again and with great mischief, because he once again can jump up and miss all the things that he couldn't see on top of the table because he can twist and turn.
Mm-hmm.
He's a younger cat.
Yeah, I think your story is an excellent example of how a person can be in tune with their pet's changing health needs as they age and make a dietary accommodation that can turn an animal's life around. And we have made significant strides through guidance for our human colleagues in human health in managing adult onset overweight condition. So there's been a tremendous surge in that research in recent years, and we have piggybacked our research onto some of that groundbreaking research in humans and shown parallels in animal nutrition. So yep, it's you can reinvent your pet with the right diet in adulthood.
And it was interesting too, because as he changed what he ate, he became more active. Does that make sense too?
It does. I think one of the things that limits an adult animal's activity is that it just simply, it causes more stress on their bone and joints to move around and jump around. It just hurts. If they've got some low-level arthritis, as many animals do as they age, including people, if you can stop the trend of groceries just cramming their cells through glycemic blood sugar modification through certain dietary changes, they will begin to shed some weight with limited activity being available to them. And if you get that ball rolling, more and more activity, more and more weight loss with these new types of diets, then you can see tremendous changes, you know, as only a cat would reward you for taking care of its health with a disassembled vole on your favorite rug. I think that's it's not good for the vole, but for the cat, it's a good example of how an animal's life was turned around.
So you if you see a dog, for instance, that looks very diabetic, is that another choice that people can do? Is change to a food that does less to raise those blood sugars?
Absolutely. A dog that has visible body fat, a little too much, you know, hard to find the ribs, those sorts of things, and a dog that particularly is starting to drink and urinate more than normal, that is a big red flag for the owner to go consult with a veterinarian to look into the possibility of the animal showing adult onset type 2 diabetes. And dietary changes, just as has been demonstrated with people, modifying the amount of carbohydrates that they're taking in, maintaining a good balance of protein and fat, higher fiber, start with low activity, and as the pounds come off, that activity will amplify. Some veterinary practices are actually offering biggest loser competitions for pets, and some veterinary practices have actually gone so far to offer it to the clients and their pets and make sort of a client-pet combination. So it can happen, absolutely.
Now, you mentioned that you might look up something about zoos. Did you hear anything interesting about diabetes in zoos, or have we talked about that already?
Well, diabetes in zoo animals it's not terribly common. I want to make that clear. When it happens, it has a tendency to happen in primates because their metabolism is similar to ours, and it's in adult or older primates, okay? And what happens there is when those behavioral changes are seen, increased periods of inactivity, increased evidence of maybe some joint pain and things associated with weight gain. Increased weight gain is evidenced by frequent weighing, as all zoos do.
And let's pause for just a second on the weight gain. That's a sign actually of poor energy metabolism, that instead of being able to use that energy for moving around, for building muscle, for doing other things, this poor body is so exhausted and the cells are so resistant to the signal of insulin that the fat cells are the latest ones to become insulin resistant. And so that's where it all goes.
Exactly. Fat cells do have a tendency to continue despite, you know, infuriatingly so sometimes. Even when the cells are saying, hey, we've had enough, the fat cells don't seem to listen quite as well. And so, yeah, weight gain, particularly adipose tissue gain, and in different species that, you know, most species will show some subcutaneous fat deposition. Humans have certain fat deposition patterns, but particularly belly fat, that tends to signal that that problem is occurring. So in getting back to the zoos, what the zoo veterinarians will do when they see that is they will do exactly what we've been talking about. They will change the diet so that there's more fiber and find foods with a lower glycemic index. For example, in certain primates, blueberries have a low glycemic index, and they make for wonderful treats and flavorings for foods that might be higher in fiber, you know, that primates might kind of go, this tastes like salad, and certain people don't like vegetables too. They want the tastier things. And so, yeah, the zoo staff will find ways to flavor those foods without sugars, and again, try to limit the amount of carbohydrates that are packing into those cells, and the weight does tend to come off.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's a lot of good information. And so you're glad with whatever he's eating, you're glad with how he's looking.
Well, for a 10-year-old dog, yeah, he's a little stiff in the hips, as you said, but I think you've done well. He just woke up and wagged his tail, so I think he's ready to go. Well, a blood sugar that stays persistently above the normal level is probably heading for a problem eventually. When the blood sugar in a dog or cat consistently stays above about 180, 170, then you start to see what we call a spillover effect, where the blood sugar actually empties into the urine, pulls water with it, and the animal's urine volume tends to increase and their thirst tends to increase. At that level, you're being signaled that there's a problem.
Pretty much like it is for humans then. That's about the level where there's very easy to measure organ damage happening at sugar levels that high.
Yeah, and we don't tend to see as parallel of changes in every type of tissue. Pets are profoundly resistant to atherosclerotic disease, but certainly changes in nerves, changes in the lens of the eye will occur in pets at that level and above, particularly if it stays elevated for long. So when you see what we call polyuria, which is too much urine being produced for that animal's daily activity level, and ingestion of too much water, the veterinary term is polydipsia, when you see an animal urinating more and drinking more, you really need to go see a veterinarian, because that could be the warning shot across the bow that your adult animal is entering into this diabetic phase.
And that's also the case with a human. If you're drinking a lot of water and peeing a lot, you should see a doctor.
Absolutely. Problems on the bottoms of your feet that don't heal. I'm getting out of my realm here. I apologize to the MDs who are listening, but there are certain symptoms of diabetes in people.
You know, you just reminded me of one more thing. Low blood sugars in animals. Does that happen very often?
It does. We see it in certain working dogs, like rescue dogs, who are jazzed up and wanting to help and going 90 miles an hour nonstop for hours. They can develop a profound drop in blood sugar as they use up all of their mobilizable glucose supplies in their tissues.
That makes sense, because their insulin level probably shot up to deal with the emergency when their blood sugar shot up. And if they're still jazzed, their insulin levels stay high a little too long.
Well, it is the case. If they get excited, their blood sugar is going to rise, and insulin will rise then. But as they start to work, as they start searching around for survivors or what have you, hunting dogs get it too, what will happen is that blood sugar will spike up, and the tissues will begin to utilize it. So the insulin levels will drop back down. But what happens is the animal is essentially akin to running a marathon and working all the time, not eating much, just go, go, go over a hard day of work. We've since learned, obviously, to enforce rest and give them small meals as they continue their work in the rescue area. But left unchecked, an animal can spend all of the stored form of sugar in its cells and get a dangerously low blood sugar.
But you see, it could be burning fat instead. But these animals are going above the fat-burning mode into their... They're like, instead of exercising at 80% of capacity, they're at 95%.
Right. It's
when an animal is burning tissue stored nutrients, with training, you can begin to develop a change in the priority with which you burn fat and sugar. But in an average working dog, they'll be burned in parallel, roughly, and blood sugar, sugar supplies tend to run out first. And so, yeah, the animal will develop hypoglycemia and become inactive, inattentive, potentially even convulse.
What sugar level is that?
Oh, that's typically a blood. It can be unreadable on a normal glucose monitor. It can be down as low as 10 or 15. Those profoundly low levels are typically associated with alterations in central nervous system function, brain function. We can see convulsions. But a hypoglycemic dog is down around 40 or 50. And if it's a working dog, they need to rest and have a snack.